Hello and welcome to the TV podcast from thevidiots at tv.org. I'm Jason Snell.
I'm Philip Michaels.
And I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
And this is our first TV podcast, and what we hope is a series of podcasts that drain our bank account in bandwidth charges until the site goes bankrupt and we close it down.
Yeah, because we failed to really capitalize on that whole website thing and turn that into a money-making cash enterprise. So maybe we can get in on this podcast thing on the ground floor. We should be very excited today, because today is, as we record this, the Miami Vice motion picture is opening up in theaters across this land of ours. And yet I am not excited. I should be excited that a wonderful childhood memory of mine has been immortalized on the silver screen, but I'm kind of not wanting to go see it.
Tell us why, Phil.
You know, I have to say, I never knew what Hialeah was before I saw the opening credits of Miami Vice.
Well, I have long argued that the opening credits of the Miami Vice TV show are, in fact, the greatest credit theme song sequence ever recorded, because it's the show, man. It's the show encapsulated in 27 seconds, and they don't have, like, the theme song that explains what the show is about. Wait, this is a story of two undercover cops, and they go on a boat.
No, it's neon and flamingos and Hialeah and shaking boobs. And
the synthesizer sounds
and
of Jan Hammer.
Cars.
And a Casio keyboard.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes.
But, I heard, they're making a movie. Well, I'm very excited about this, because I used to devote my Friday nights to Miami Vice because I had nothing to do being a loser nerd.
And having your name be one letter away from one of the stars
of the
show.
Yes.
Kind of an inverted thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
did they call you Rico?
They did, and I punched them.
See. So it really was you lived Miami Vice.
Of the two stars on the Miami Vice TV program, that's not the one you want your name to be like.
Yeah.
Why would you want your name to be Don Johnson?
No, at least you're thinking of the Nash Bridges Don Johnson, where he's kind of, creepy and lame, whereas back in 1985, 1986, Don Johnson was the cat's meow. He was catnip to the ladies and other things involving cats.
This is back when America
was
on
cool.
drugs, right?
Yes.
All right,
when America needed to say no.
Back in 1984, 85, Philip Michael Thomas was not cool and never was cool.
No.
And
so that's 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So if we look out into the future, say, you see where I'm going with this, 10 or 15 years into the future, what shows of today will be completely disowned by the creators and bastardized into terrible motion pictures?
That's why I'm not excited about the movie.
I have very high hopes for CSI as a movie franchise. And I don't think they're going to have any of the original actors. They may have the children of the original actors. But I can easily see a two-hour movie where all they do are solve gruesome sex crimes in Las Vegas. And this time they can actually show naked bodies without warnings ahead of time, and they can drop the F-bomb occasionally.
The original
and
actor.
And Quentin Tarantino can direct it.
The original actors can play corpses. They can have
cameos.
So instead of what they did with Miami Vice, which is apparently, having not seen the movie, but apparently convert what was sort of a gritty crime drama of its time into a joyless rehash with different actors. Lisa, what you seem to be advocating is,
well, CSI is already a joyless
taking a joyless show, pulling out the actors, maybe, and rehashing it anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Or, what they could do is they could do a Law and Order movie and just have Dick Wolf fire the actors halfway through. Just keep changing the actors between Act 1, Act 2, Act 3.
Different scene. Yeah. I thought you were Sam Waterston.
Yes.
I'm that guy who went crazy and ran off to Canada.
Or, the joke is actually that in
Michael Moriarty.
Yes.
Or the joke is that in each different scene, Sam Waterston is talking to a different female assistant attorney.
Oh, right, yeah.
Where he just kind of goes through a Penelope. Think of the cross-in. Think of the Maxim covers that could go with that. Think of the red carpet potential. I think it's an idea with legs.
The procedural dramas could easily become movies 15 years from now, because it's not like they have any mythology. It's almost like they're movies now, because they kind of stand alone as individual episodes without any overriding narrative, except for Grissom and Sarah doing it last year.
I know, I can't believe they're doing it now. I was kind of horrified by that ending.
I don't know. I've seen CSI, but not for many years, and I'm a better person because of it.
They're now a couple.
Which one is she? Is she the one who got fired and had to beg for her job back?
That's her.
Yes.
And apparently this was the price they extracted from her. You've got to kiss William Peterson.
Oh, man.
Pick his beard. Pick out the nips.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, I think you might be right. The procedurals, there's this class of movie remakes of TV shows where nothing of the show survives except the name. And mm-hmm. I think the best example of that is SWAT. Does anybody even
Colin Farrell will star in every TV movie remake.
When they do the St. Elsewhere movie, I bet you he'll be the rapist doctor.
No, he'll be the Howie Mandel character and put a glove over his head. Except he'll be serious about it.
Brooding.
So I actually read a story the other week that said that the producers of Lost were considering the possibility of doing a movie.
See, I was just about to cut in there and think, they can't do a Lost movie. That would be like the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island.
Well, and you know what?
We are in our reunion. We were lost on that island for years and years. Now let's get back together and have a... Oh, God, we're lost again!
Yeah. What would happen is if they... You can see the scenario coming like a train wreck, which is they get to the end of whatever season they've decided to end on, and they won't end the show because instead they will have the climactic finale happen in the movie. Although, you know, really by the time a show is about to end, it's run out of steam and nobody wants to see the movie, which is why you get this sort of X-Files scenario where they make the movie at the height of the popularity of the show. And then the show has nowhere to go because they've kind of gone off in this rabbit hole where there was this movie.
They were supposed to make another X-Files
movie. Yes.
I guess David Carter.
Duchovny.
Chris Carter and David Duchovny.
I merged them into one. I guess Chris Carter is too busy counting his money.
You know what genre we have
filing his lawsuits
with the TV to movie big screen is sitcoms. Because if you look at the recent rash of adaptations, a lot of them are sitcom based. There was that awful Bewitched movie, and I think that in the next 10 to 15 years, we may actually see Friends as like a very bitter Big Chill esque type of comedy, where you know Monica and Chandler are having marital difficulties and Rachel is doing whatever it is she does, blah, blah, blah. I think sitcoms will be where they actually do mine for material.
It wouldn't surprise me, although it's funny you mentioned Friends. I've actually noticed a couple of these news stories the last few weeks where various cast members of Friends who don't have jobs are saying, I'd do a reunion show, sure.
Call me, Mara.
George Clooney, Mark Wahlberg, 2.5 Men.
There you
go. Who
would
be the half man?
I don't know.
Could it be one of the Afflecks?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture sort of a Ray Romano, Kevin James, King of Queens versus Everybody Loves Raymond mashup film where everybody dies.
Everybody Loves Raymond versus King of Queens sounds like one of those Godzilla versus Megalodon.
That's exactly
movies.
What I'm
everybody
thinking.
Everybody dies.
That's what I'm thinking. And then everybody dies at the end because there's a UPS.
See, Veronica's Closet is kind of like an updated Requiem for a Dream.
Oh.
You have Christy crawling across the floor,
God.
Hallucinating.
You see, maybe it's the not having the benefit of hindsight, but I don't know what TV shows today are going to be movies 15 years from now. And one of the reasons I think is we just don't have TV shows with that distinct Miami Vice aesthetic or a Magnum P.I. aesthetic. And if you don't think there's going to be a Magnum P.I. movie.
I hope there is.
In
I
like
hope
three
they bring
or four years.
Selleck.
Well, if they can do the Transformers as a movie.
Yes.
Which is coming.
Uh-huh.
You know it's coming. I've seen the posters.
Robots in disguise.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Robotic actors in disguise.
I'm looking forward to the since Michael Mann is mining his old TV shows for movies. Maybe he can mine his old movies for TV shows and like create The Insider, but as a wacky sitcom where it's, Insider, you are having more tobacco-filled antics this week.
Is Mike Wallace his wacky neighbor in this scenario?
Yeah. No, exactly. It's like Wilson in Home Improvement. You only see half of his face.
Everybody loves Heat.
Manhunter, the musical comedy.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. What will Manhunter? What will you think of next?
Exactly.
Hannibal Lecter. We're having a dinner party tonight. Oh no!
No.
I know. I brought crudités.
I never should have brought these fava beans.
No.
Okay. I wish I could say that Carell is bad, but that would imply that I have some frame of reference to judge him against.
People may not know, but behind the scenes on TV.org, we actually have a little mailing list with all the vidiots on it, and we some of the most amusing and exciting things that happen are behind the curtain and never see the light of day.
Too hot for prime time.
Yes.
That's because many of them are libelous, the things we say.
And laced with profanity.
Yes, it gets a little blue behind the scenes.
Yes. We can't have you think that we curse.
Oh, no.
Except for when we curse on the site.
That's the only time.
Yeah.
So this is the segment, I should say, where we plan on going behind the scenes and revealing the secrets on the TV mailing list. And the big topic of discussion this time was actually something startling that happened at the Television Critic Association Awards ceremony in Los Angeles last week, which is the
Carol Burnett's Lifetime Achievement Award.
That's right. I never got her. I really just never thought she was that funny. No, the fact that Steve Carell won for Best Actor in a Comedy for The Office, which I think is absolutely deserved, and used his time on stage thanking the television critics by reading verbatim several paragraphs from Peter Coe's review on TV.org of the high-quality 1997 sitcom Over the Top, which I think startled everybody on the mailing list, mm-hmm. the mysterious Peter Coe most of all. But I think all of us were a little shocked that we would have our work read in public. And
We were not shocked that it was read unattributed, uncredited, and unbylined.
No, although to Steve Carell's credit, it sounds like afterward when all the TV critics just assumed that he had made it up himself because he is some sort of comedy genius, mm-hmm. that Steve Carell did, rather than say, yes, I am a very funny man, he said, no, it's really on the internet. You can look it up. It's on TV.org. So at least he did. The thing that gets me about this is that this review was written in 1997, so we're talking about 9 years ago. And we got an email from Stephen Colbert when he and Carell were at The Daily Show in 2001, at the end of 2001. Like, those guys didn't have enough to do at The Daily Show in late 2001.
Kind of a slow news year.
Yeah, nothing really happened in September of 2001. So we got an email then. So I have this vision that Colbert and Carell were basically just ego surfing on Google and found this article, but it says something to me that even if you take 2001 as the time when he found out about this, we're talking about 5 years later, the first thing that comes to his mind is this review, this admittedly kind of over-the-top, nasty review of Over the Top that Pete Coe wrote for TV.
And yet, I read through the review, and having seen the pilot episode of Over the Top, I can't speak for Pete, but I stand by every word that he wrote. That was just a memorably terrible show. And Steve Carell, who I think is a fantastic actor, wonderful on The Office, should have been nominated for an Oscar for The 40-Year-Old Virgin, I think.
Absolutely.
But on that show, one of the worst performances ever on. I would encourage some enterprising person to go to the Museum of TV and Radio and try and dig up old footage of Over the Top.
It needs to
then
be
stick it on YouTube.
YouTube, yes, yeah. Exactly. I think Pete had a premise in his piece, which his piece was definitely written to be over the top, and yet I've heard from several TV critics that it's sort of like, well, I wish I could get away with that kind of thing in my newspaper.
So my question is, why can't you?
Well, I think sometimes you see it. I think that a lot of times, you know, the TV critics want to be, you know, they want to be fair. They don't want to be mean. They don't want to make personal attacks. I thought Pete actually didn't make he made some personal attacks. They were all directed at Tim Curry.
Yeah.
But really the point was that Carell was bad and was doing this crazy character. And I think Pete's premise was right, which was to deflect some attention from how awful Tim Curry was. They had this other character that was more ridiculous than him. Mm-hmm. And that was, unfortunately, Steve Carell had to be that guy.
Mm-hmm. But he's doing well for himself now.
He's doing okay. I will note that he didn't make mention of Pete likening him to Himmler, Tim Curry's Hitler.
I would bet that's why he remembered the piece. Well, how often do you get compared to Himmler in any review?
It is actually, I have to say, when I looked it up, that Heap of Gobs of Curry, which you can find on the TV website, is one of my favorite things that we've ever published, because it's so funny. And the fact is, anybody who went to this piece after hearing those items and expected it to be some sort of vitriolic screed posted in a message board that was then cleaned up by Steve Carell, it's definitely not the case. And any piece that begins with a quote of Horace Walpole, mm-hmm. and can use that literary device of 18th century English artistic society to get into a piece about Over the Top with Tim Curry and Annie Potts is doing something right.
It's a little known fact about Pete, though, that he begins every piece with a quote by Horace Walpole.
That's why he doesn't write for us anymore.
It's really very cliched, and I wish he'd stop doing that.
He
did. He stopped writing altogether around 2000.
Yes, but you know, but now he has subpoena power. So.
That's right.
Who's on top now, Carell? You've got your little award, but...
And that was actually a comment that somebody made on the list, thereby bringing us back around to the main point of this segment.
That's right. We were all a little bit shocked and a little bit stunned by what we found on the websites about Steve Carell reading our stuff, but I think it's pretty cool. And I mean, this is not our first brush with fame. We've been in Daily Variety, we've been in Entertainment Weekly, we've gotten emails from producers like Phil Rosenthal, from Everybody Loves Raymond, and from J.J.
Abrams.
And
we would like to hear from more of you. We would like more brushes with fame. We would like to be brushed with fame every day.
Absolutely.
And I think the only way one of my reviews ever gets read at a TV critic's dinner is if Tony Danza somehow...
Actually,
an award,
but you had your moment in the spotlight when your sort of middling review of that sitcom with the guy from MTV got quoted on an MTV thing. Dan Cortez.
I was mentioned by name, and no one said, Dan Cortez, you had to write that review. No one could write that.
No, but he did suggest that perhaps he'd been giving you drinks at his house before you wrote it. So
yes.
You should have sued him for slander.
You know, I'm hoping we'll hear from Steve Carell at some point. That would be awfully nice.
Yeah.
We'd get Pete Coe in a cubicle in the office one day.
Mm-hmm. That would be
or serving a subpoena.
Or getting served.
And initiating a federal investigation.
Until Steve Carell's turn in the premiere of Over the Top, I have never known true horror.
Now it's time for a segment that, like all the other segments we're doing for the first time, the idea here is that everybody who would like to can pop off a little bit on a topic of their choosing. For this podcast, we'll only have a handful, but I think in the future, all
this
the videos
has long been my favorite segment of the TV podcast.
It is the favorite with the listeners as well. So Lisa Schmeiser will begin.
Take it away. I watch Monk. I like Monk. I like Monk a lot because I like pointing out all the parts that aren't San Francisco, even though they're trying to pretend they are. But here's the most critical thing. I like Monk because Trailer Howard is doing a fantastic job on that show. As avid TV viewers know, she came in and replaced Biddy Schramm when Biddy played hardball.
Asked for a raise, yes.
Yeah, played hardball with her salary and lost. And everything about the way Trailer Howard plays Natalie Teeger has just added to the show immeasurably. I like that she calls her boss Mr. Monk because it gives a whole new dimension to the relationship between her and Monk that Sharona didn't have with Monk. I like the way that she banters back and forth with the cops, who, I may add, are also priceless on that show. And I like the way that she's the voice of common decency. If Sharona was the brash defender of all things Monk, pushing Adrian to be more assertive and pushing him to plow over obstacles and things like that. Trailer Howard's character is the one who comes through and points out that, hey, people have problems too. You have to think of their feelings and you have to be as considerate of them as you'd like them to be of you. She humanizes the show. She brings a lighter, defter touch to it. And I think it's time that people stop bashing her for not being Biddy Schramm and Sharona and just start appreciating the fact that the show has a much needed civil edge. The writers have gotten mean to Monk lately. They've made the endings depressing. They've put him in increasingly outlandish and humiliating scenarios. And she brings a little dignity to the show. And coming from the person who got her start on Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place, that's a pretty remarkable achievement.
It's summertime, and that means that some shows that usually aren't on reappear in the summer. This is not me talking about Big Brother. No, in fact, I'm going to talk about Rockstar on CBS. I like Rockstar. I like it better than American Idol. And I know that American Idol is the most popular show in the history of mankind. And there are many things about it that I find interesting. I think one of the reasons I prefer Rockstar is because I frankly prefer classic rock music and modern rock music over the kind of soft, crappy pop music that is the song list for American Idol. Rockstar clears better songs than American Idol, partially because the quality of the contestants is actually better. These people are professional singers, and they don't butcher songs, and American Idol takes great delight in having terrible singers butcher songs. But one of the reasons that I really like Rockstar has to do with its premise, and most specifically with its results show. The worst thing about American Idol is the results show. It's essentially a concept that came from the UK, from the show Pop Idol. And in the UK, being a small country with one time zone, the way it worked was everybody performed, they cut away for the news, and then they came back and gave the results, and there was a winner, and there was somebody was eliminated, and then you saw them again next week. In the United States, you can't do that. So instead, they had to separate the results show and put it on another night. And what we get is a half hour or an hour of nothing, followed by, in the last minute, Ryan Seacrest declaring, you're gone, see you, and we'll see you next week.
And now that you've been eliminated, sing the song that got you thrown off
sing
the show.
The one song that nobody wants to hear again will now be performed again over the end credits.
I disagree. I love when they ask them to sing the song that got them booted off the show, because I like watching which contestants are going to absolutely lose it.
Well, and in fact, this most recent season on American Idol, I believe there was at least one contestant who they didn't even allow to sing. They just said, goodbye. House is next. Goodbye.
But, I'll do House.
But Rockstar, you know, American Idol's never going to change their premise because they're the number one show in the history of mankind, and why should they? But Rockstar is brilliant, and it shows why Mark Burnett is the king of reality TV. Their results show serves a couple of purposes. First off, they have an encore, which is the best performance from the previous night, which you actually would want to see again. And then what they do is, rather than just eliminate the lowest vote-getter, they pick the lowest three vote-getters, and each of them has to sing another song specifically chosen for them to stay on the show, which means they're motivated to sing because the one who does the worst presumably will be the one selected by the judges to go home. So this deals with a lot of issues with American Idol's format. It deals with the fact that people are singing songs that we haven't heard them sing before. They have a reason to sing them well. We have a situation where the judges are not useless. They actually have something to do. And if there's been a travesty of justice, and somebody has gotten the lowest number of votes who probably doesn't deserve to go home, you have this sort of scenario where they don't, because the judges will pick the worst of the bottom three. So there's sort of this mediating factor that reduces the problems with a popular vote. And in the end, what you get is a show that's just more entertaining, because you've got four relatively good performances. Yes, you're watching the three lowest vote getters sing, but in a lot of times, it's a mulligan. They had a bad show, and they came back, and they sang a good song. And there's some drama there, because you don't know, and they're trying to fight for their lives and stay on the show. I'm not saying that American Idol is ever going to fix their format, but I say that Rockstar, which gets a fraction of the ratings of American Idol, shows that the American Idol format isn't the best format for that show. It may be the most popular show, but it's certainly not the best format, because that results show makes me want to cry. It's great on TiVo because you can just watch 1 minute, or it's great on the internet because you can go to the Television Without Pity forums into the American Idol thread and see who got bumped off and then not actually watch the results show. But the Rockstar results show I actually enjoy watching. And so, you know, thumbs up to Rockstar on CBS for creating a music reality show that not only has some good songs, that they can clear good songs, but actually does the format right.
It's summertime, as Jason observed.
It is summertime, yes. Unless you're in the Southern Hemisphere.
Is the living easy?
No. Right. And usually that's the time of the year that I don't watch much television, because it's baseball season, so I'm spending like 2 hours a night watching a baseball game. But it's also the time of year when I begin to reassess the shows that I do watch in the fall, and which ones will be, you know, which ones I'll be coming back to when they return. And, you know, you have your Offices and your My Name is Earls, and those will be coming back. I think I'm about to ask Without a Trace to leave my TiVo to-do list. And it's not because I dislike the show or because the show is badly produced. In fact, it's I think, very well acted, very well written. One of the best procedural dramas on television. But it's just so unrelentingly depressing. And I keep thinking back to that episode where Gordon Clapp guest starred as the guy who was wrongfully accused of being a pedophile, and it turns out he was just posing as one to try and track down a missing person, and then
that was just so depressing.
And then the rest of the team gets involved, and they eventually find the girl, and of course she's in this horrible abusive relationship, and they finally manage to rescue her and return her to her family, and she's horribly emotional.
emotional scarred, and the episode ends with Gordon Clapp sobbing uncontrollably, and that was a happy ending. And I remember watching that episode and going, you know what, I have enough awful things going on in my life that I don't need to be made sad by it. And it's just, it's the conceit of the TV show. You're dealing with missing persons. Missing people don't often get found. Missing people don't often get found in good working order. And it's just so unrelentingly depressing that I'm not sure I need to take an hour out of my life each week to be sad about fictional people. I don't have a problem with depressing TV show. I watch The Wire, and the theme of that show might as well be, why fucking bother?
Hey-o, it's podcasting.
But at least there's a larger narrative and characters. And here it's just, well, someone else is missing. Oh, God, they're dead. Well, let's play a sad pop song as we fade to the credits. So, Without a Trace, you're a fine show. You deserve every accolade and viewer that you get. I won't be one of those viewers.
This is another longtime popular segment on the TV podcast called Improve This Show.
I remember the first time we did the Improve This Show segment.
It was about Perfect Strangers, I believe.
Yeah, I suggested...
more wacky accents.
No, I think I suggested burying Balky in a coal mine. And that would just be it.
Yeah.
People would watch.
Improve This Show, as we've explained, is you,
or not.
You throw out the name of a show, and then everybody has to make a snap decision about a few quick ways where this show could be improved. Okay, so the topic of this podcast, Improve This Show, is the long-running, sort of mistreated NBC sitcom Scrubs. Phil, how would we improve Scrubs?
Well,
start with giving it a time slot where it stays. And
that would be nice, or not like making it disappear from the schedule and then bringing it back in January and tell people a week before, hey, Scrubs is back, and now it's gone. I like the show, but I think they should stop with these really strange, out-of-place episode arcs where Dr. Cox becomes a drunkard, or Carla and Turk. This was my favorite, when Carla and Turk had the had marital difficulties out of nowhere, because they felt like they had to add some gravitas
to
the
show. Weeks.
Yeah, yeah. That's oh God, this is the most terrible month ever of our marriage, and now it's beautiful again.
Well, actually, I think you make a good point there, which is what I've said since the beginning, which is Scrubs is MASH without a war. They want to be MASH. It wants to be MASH. And I think the dramatic arcs are that sort of late-era MASH problem where it's like, oh, we've got to say some serious things or put our characters in serious situations. And Scrubs, so I'll say, to fix this show, be Scrubs and don't be MASH. MASH didn't have wild, crazy flights of fancy, mm-hmm. dream sequence kind of stuff, which Scrubs actually does a pretty good job on. Stick to what you're good at. I mean, Scrubs is good at that sort of mm-hmm. thing. Scrubs is not so great at the bizarre... I mean, I'm okay with character development in dramatic situations, but these arcs where it feels like there's a timer going off that's like, we have four episodes where there will be marital problems, and then it will be resolved. And you can see the clock ticking down, and you know it's all going to be okay in the end. And it's not what they do well.
No.
Well, I disagree, because I think what you should do is you should put Dr. Cox in a dress.
Okay. Well,
would you care to expand upon that?
How would this improve the show, Lisa?
Oh.
Klinger, you've ruined this hospital again.
Actually, if I could
exactly.
bring, if
I couldn't resist the line.
If I could bring up my, I know what my wife would say about how to improve this show, which is, could we not have any more implausibly beautiful blonde women parishooting into the show every week?
Could we not have so many women crazy about JD? He's needy. He's clingy. He's unhealthily codependent. He lives in his head half the time. He's manipulative, and he's a girl, like, you know, with the apple teenies and the cuddling and this and that. And the fact that apparently half of Los Angeles is dying to sleep with him is just baffling. Just make him single for a season. Make him single and stick him in a closet half the time. That's how I would improve the show, is less JD.
Well, I would say not less JD, but less JD's romantic entanglements and more of... I would watch a show that was just stupid things that JD and Turk did, because I think that's perhaps the best relationship between two characters on TV right now. It's just a wonderful relationship.
As I often say, I agree with your wife, but I would expand that to be, let's limit the celebrity cameos.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, the beautiful blonde women who parachute in are often celebrity cameos.
Right. And I because that show is in danger of becoming Will and Grace in the final years, where it's, and now Alec Baldwin has taken up permanent residence on the Will and Grace set, and we can't get him to leave.
I should also add that being a girl, there is nothing pejorative about girly, and that's actually one of the funniest things about JD, is how unabashedly he owns his metrosexual side. But I've also got to add that I find it highly implausible that
all the girls would be falling over him.
I don't want to have to fight with a man over product.
Right.
Now you tell me.
Well, that's why I married you.
Exactly.
And that is how we would fix Scrubs. So get
Lawrence.
On it, Bill Lawrence.
Send us your check.
Yes.
Well, yeah, stop this silly nobody's watching thing. Didn't anyone tell you the internet will never amount to anything? Mm-hmm.
Lisa can give recommendations on what dress you can get John McGinley in.
I think he'd look nice in a wrap dress. Diane von Furstenberg, maybe.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the janitor still has no name. And God bless him.
That's, I like that.
That's wonderful.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Don't change that, Bill Lawrence.
I love his janitor posse.
Yeah, don't do the Kramer thing where his name gets revealed.
No.
Because that killed Seinfeld.
That's right. That's why Jerry Seinfeld is dead today.
Yeah. It literally killed Jerry Seinfeld. Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to the end of this, the 8,000th TV podcast. Or the first, depending on how you count. I'm counting backward from 8,000.
It just seems like we've done 8,000.
And yet it's
podcasts.
Just the one.
Yeah, because...
When did we sell the syndication rights?
I'm getting right on that.
Right on.
Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this podcast. And you can always send us your feedback at tv@tv.org. And that will go to our aforementioned mailing list, and then we'll make fun of your emails. So please send in your comments about the podcast.
And perhaps we'll even read them on the air and make fun of you on the air, too. Because we're very versatile when it comes to making fun of people.
We recognize the many-to-many power of the internet that way.
Thank you, Lisa. Mm-hmm. And so for the TV podcast, I'm Jason Snell.
I'm Philip Michaels.
And I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
Thanks for listening. Courage.